listeners, and welcome back to Black in Boston and Beyond, a podcast of the Trotter Institute at UMass Boston. I'm Hetty V. Williams, your host. Today on Black in Boston and Beyond, we have Mr. Lamont Jones, author of The Gist of Bidwist, The Culturally Rich Game from Black America for You, a book recently published by Clyde Hill Publishing. Welcome to the show, Mr. Jones.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Williams. I really appreciate you taking time to visit with me.
Yes, thank you so much for stopping by and joining me on the show today to talk about this book, especially in a time when I think so many people have turned away from board games, card games, and sort of, you know, on the computer playing games. And also a time in which community, you know, there's a great discussion about the death of conversation and community. And I think your book is really talking about how this card game can bring us together again and teach us many lessons about life. But let's start first with your own background, your professional experience before we get into this, you know, discussion of your excellent book here.
Well, thank you. Well, I'm a lawyer by profession. I happen to work in the fight game, in the boxing business. I'm an attorney with Al Heyman's Premier Boxing Champions Platform, PBC, as it's known in the business. It's been the advisor for dozens of world champions. And Mr. Heyman is a legend in the sport. And I'm thrilled to have a ringside seat for some of the good work that he does on behalf of boxers and on behalf of boxing fans.
Okay, so how does a lawyer and someone involved in the sporting world, I'm wondering, get introduced to this game? And, you know, that's our next question. How did you first learn about Bidwist? Was it growing up or just in your professional life? Tell us a little bit about that story.
You know, I came to Bidwist relatively late. I grew up as a spades player. Yeah, I learned how to play spades when I was 10 or 11 years old, which was thrilling because, you know, I got to move from the kids' table to the adults' table to play some cards. So throughout my teenage years and throughout my college years, I was a spades player. And on the first day of law school, I met three fellas, and a couple of them suggested, hey, you guys want to play some cards? And my response was, yeah, let's bust some spades, right? And these fellas said, oh, we got something that is even better than spades. So I resisted that notion for a while, but they wore me down. I was introduced to Bidwist, and I've been a passionate enthusiast since. And I'll just end the answer by saying, you know, I grew up as a spades player. I suggest that most of us have some sort of card game story. I'd be interested, if it's okay for me to ask, you know, whether you played any card games and what your card game story is.
So my card game story is I'm the daughter of a Pentecostal preacher. So if anybody listening today is familiar with Pentecostalism, we are typically, or if you grow up a Pentecostal in a Pentecostal household, you are likely never going to be playing cards because they're more or less forbidden. Mm-hmm. But when I went off to college, one of the ways to pass time was to play spades. So everybody got together and said, all right, let's, you know, what are we going to do tonight? Let's play spades. Let's partner up and play. So I had a roommate who was very proficient, and she decided, you know, hey, I'll teach you how to play. You could be my partner. And we turned out to be the baddest duo in the dorm. She taught me, and I said, all right, I'm ready. So that's my card game story. But just looking at your book made me think about, like, the value of card games and games in general in the African-American culture. This is what caught my interest in this book. You know, this culturally rich card game that you call it. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit more about Bidwist and how is it like spades is one of my questions. But what exactly is this card game all about?
Well, and I definitely want to get into what you were saying about the sort of bonding that the game fosters. But I will say this to people who play spades, to people who play Bidwist, to people who might not play any card games. Bidwist is first and foremost a partnership game. So that distinguishes it, for example, from blackjack, where you're playing against the dealer, or from poker, where you're playing against each other player at the table. In Bidwist, as in spades, as in bridge, you have a partner, okay? And you're playing against another partnership. So there comes a point in time when each of the four players at the table will lay down a card. So there'll be a pile of four cards in the middle of the table. That pile is called a trick or a book. In spades, we call it a book, right? So the objective is to try to win as many of those tricks as you can. But before that trick-taking action starts, there's a conversation. And during that conversation, both partnerships basically make a wager as to how many of the tricks they're going to win in the upcoming round. And that sort of that conversation, that wager, lends a lot of the tension and the spiciness to the game. So those are the basic three elements of BidWhist. And I suspect, Dr. Williams, that as a spades player, some of what you just heard about BidWhist would have sounded familiar to you.
Yes, definitely. I just thought about our nickname because there's a part of the book where you talk about there's a lot of boasting that goes on.
Indeed.
And so our nicknames for the game, once I learned how to play, my roommate was very petite. She had to be 110 pounds wet, right? She was the little joker and I was the big joker. That was our name. That was our partnership name. The Tom Tops, that was my roommate back in the day. We would go around and people was like, oh, here comes the big joker and little joker.
And I like what you said about what your roommate did for you. She sort of, you know, brought you to the table, showed you the ropes, so to speak, taught you the game. That's what I'm trying to do for people with BidWhist. I'm trying to do, you know, what your roommate did for you. And again, I'm trying to do that not just for the folks who play spades and know a little bit about cards already, but even for the people who say, you know what, I just don't get this whole card playing thing. I don't have the card playing gene. I'm the one that even grandma beats in the family. I believe that the card game concepts are accessible and we can all learn them and apply them. And even as I'm doing that, I'm trying to enthrall and entertain those of us who already play BidWhist. So that's why I focus a lot on stories and practice hands and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think this theme of partnership and community, which is something that many, you know, I guess cultural critics are sort of, you know, very concerned with analyzing at the moment, the loss of community with the rise of the internet and social media. And I think you're emphasizing this as a theme throughout the book, how to build community beyond the game, in the game, within the game, but also beyond the game. And I think that's a very important insight, community building through game.
No question. I have to say that, you know, in my early years of playing spades and my first few years of playing BidWhist, for me, it was all about the competition, right? That was my way to compete. I grew up as an amateur boxer. I had a couple hundred fights as an amateur boxer. And playing cards was an extension of that desire to compete. But what I learned after I left law school, first of all, I couldn't find people to play with, you know? So you have to have a level of collaboration to even organize a game to play BidWhist because there are relatively few players. But that was really driven home for me when my daughter was about 6 years old. Her mom and I went through a divorce. And not long after that, we had my daughter seeing a therapist. And during that session, Aaliyah, my daughter, shared that she was upset and sad and angry about her new life. And the therapist asked, well, have you told anybody about this? And Aaliyah says, well, I've told my daddy. Well, why have you told him? And Aaliyah, in her eight-year-old way, says, well, when I'm with him, we spend time playing cards. And when you're sitting there playing cards, you got to talk about something. So when her mom shared that anecdote with me, it really drove home for me the fact that as much as I love competition, as much as I love the smack talk, these games really can be about bonding and connection. I think BidWhist is just a wonderful vehicle for bonding and connection. And that's part of what drove me to start researching it more and learning more about it and writing this book.
Yeah, I think that's like one of my favorite themes in this book. So can you tell us a little bit, because you start out in the beginning of the book telling us a little bit about the roots of the game or the historical origins, and then you get quickly into how it became popular among African Americans. Can you elaborate a little bit on the origins?
Sure. It was fascinating for me to learn that poker and craps, for example, were games that originated in New Orleans and were kind of injected into the nation's bloodstream via the Mississippi River. We all have sort of the image in our head of, you know, riverboat gamblers and such. And that's where those games came from. But BidWhist has the distinction of being popularized via the railroads by a singular group of men, the Pullman Porters. And it's tough. Well, it's interesting to think about now, but in the early decades of the 20th century, train travel was at the very epicenter of American life. And if the research reveals that on a given night, more people spent the night on overnight trains than in all the nation's top hotels combined. And central to that train travel experience were the Pullman porters. They attended to the needs of the passengers and that sort of thing. And even though this job had its menial aspects, the porters had a special role in Black society, right? They were not tethered to their jobs at a factory in a particular place. They were able to travel across the country. So they were sort of urbane and cosmopolitan figures. And as they traveled, they shared information that helped fuel the Great Migration. They would share the Black newspapers, the Chicago Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier. You know, they'd share information about, hey, if you're coming to Oakland and you're looking for a place to live, try this area. Or if you're in St. Louis and you need a job, you know, talk to these people. And they were also purveyors of culture. You know, they'd share the latest jazz records or the latest blues records. And one of the aspects of culture that they shared was something that was dear to them, their favorite pastime, bid whist. They played it so much that it was called the Porter's Game. So given the Porter's sort of central role and their popularity and the respect that they garnered, the fact that this was their game helped them popularize it and spread it throughout the country.
Yeah, I like your point about the Pullman porters. A lot of people may look, if we look back at the past and assume, oh, these were men who worked on the train. They didn't have, you know, a high status. They had a high status. They were considered middle class.
No question.
Workers at the time. And people did look to them for information as they went from town to town on these trains. And they did have a particular status in, you know, Black societies. So no, I think question. That's a good point that you make here, and you know, in the conversation and the book.
Yeah. And the part about it that fascinates me most, Dr. Williams, is the fact that, you know, the porters were ultimately big contributors to the civil rights movement, right? So they sort of viewed their mission as not just getting, you know, better hours and better pay for themselves, but also as striking a blow for, you know, dignity and freedom for all of Black America. All of Black America. And after they were able to successfully negotiate a contract with the Pullman Company, the leader of the porters, A. Philip Randolph, became one of the deans of the civil rights movement. And the porters contributed money to the civil rights movement. They contributed organizational know-how, that sort of thing. So much so that, as you know, when we had the March on Washington in 1963, Mr. Randolph was the speaker who spoke right before Dr. King. And a big part of that was because the March on Washington had originally been Mr. Randolph's idea way back in 1940. So I thought that was important. What was even more fascinating to me is that, you know, before the porters were successful in negotiating the contract with the Pullman Company, they endured some dark days. You know, it was 12 years from the date that the porters sort of officially organized until they were successful in negotiating that contract. And during those dark days, they didn't have a lot of money. And one of the things that A. Philip Randolph did to sort of keep his union together, to keep this band of brothers together, was he'd sit down with them, inquire about their concerns, and they'd play bid whist. And the bid whist helped to increase the camaraderie amongst the group. And I thought it was fascinating then that bid whist, in some small way at least, provided some of the scaffolding for some of the later contributions and achievements of the Pullman porters.
Yeah, I think that's so well put. That's one of the great stories of the book, I think, and the story of this card game that they carry across America. And through building brotherhood, camaraderie, and community, like this game was sort of the backdrop of the planning for a larger movement, like you say, the March on Washington movement that begins in the 1940s and that's carried forward.
Absolutely. But because the porters were so popular, you know, eventually the game was picked up by people in the military and played on military bases. And then the people brought it back home. And as you know, people, you know, played in college and bid whist became, you know, a theme of the sort of the weekend gatherings and the fight parties and, you know, was played at conventions and that sort of thing. And I think that's why Professor Henry Louis Skip Gates calls bid whist the national Black pastime.
Very powerful, I think, description. Tell us some more about the game and how it's played. I want to play this game after I read this book.
I like it. So we know about the partnership element, the trick-taking element. I'm sure you've heard about some of the smack talk and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I would say that Bidwist is sort of like a remix of your favorite card games. It takes elements from spades, right? So some of this will be familiar to you, but it remixes them in a certain way that sort of ratchets up the tension and ratchets up the action. I'll give you a couple quick examples. In spades, for example, you know, it would have been possible for you and your partner, Little Joker, to, say, make a bid of five books. And at the same time, your opponents could have made a bid of, say, seven books, right? And both partnerships could have been successful on that particular hand. Both could have made their bid. That can't happen in Bidwist. In Bidwist, you know, the structure of the game is such that if one team succeeds, the other team necessarily fails. That's one difference. The biggest difference, I call this one the knockout factor, right? Because I'm sure you've played spades before and you've been in a situation where maybe you weren't successful early on a hand and now you're behind and you're sort of hopelessly behind. The game has to continue until somebody scores 500, but the team that has the lead, they get a little bit more conservative in their bidding and, you know, you really don't have much of a chance to catch up, all right? Let's move to Bidwist and think with me for a second about tennis, okay? In tennis, you can only score a point on set point, right? You've accumulated a certain number of points. You can only win a game on game point. So, you know, you've accumulated a certain number of points, and then at the pivotal point, you can win the game. The same thing with respect to the set. You can only win the set after you've won a certain number of games. And on this point, now you can win the set. And same thing with respect to the match, okay? In Bidwist, doesn't matter what the score is, doesn't matter whether your team is ahead or whether your team is behind, you can, you know, with the right collection of cards, the right bid, and the right strategy, score a knockout punch that amounts to game point, set point, match point, all in one, right? Mm-hmm. So because that possibility exists, both sides have to be alert for it at all times. And that influences everything that goes on from the bidding to the play, et cetera. So the knockout factor in Bidwist goes a long way towards, in my view, distinguishing it from spades and all the other games and making it, you know, even more exciting, even more fun.
Yeah, it does. I like the idea of the knockout. Yeah, when you get behind in spades, you're done. Like, you know, when you're done in spades, it's different in that way. I like the comparison and contrast there. So what made you want to write a book about this card game? You sound so enthusiastic, I think, about this game and its value and worth in African-American culture.
I'll tell you, I remember playing in a game in Los Angeles, and the host of the party, a woman named Victoria McGee, just sort of offhandedly mentioned that the Pullman Porters had been important, you know, in popularizing the game. So that just sort of sparked in me the urge to know more about the game and to research it more. I was alert for anecdotes and people, you know, Bidwist players, you know, we all have different anecdotes and different stories and such. So with that sort of research interest, you know, at the time I had played a little bit of spades and I saw the way that spades was taught. And I thought, man, it would be cool if Bidwist could be taught in this sort of structured way, this sort of unintimidating way. I had the situation, you know, with my daughter that highlighted for me how important this game can be as a vehicle for connection. That caused me to reflect on, you know, the relationships and the bonds I built at the Bidwist table. And I just felt that the game deserved more attention, more thought than it had previously been given. So that started me down the path of writing the gist of Bidwist. And then just wanting to share with more people, you know, the thrills of this game, the joy of this game, and maybe more importantly than that, you know, the connections and the joy and the relationships that can be built from this game.
And you talk a lot about leadership, and then you also make a connection to sports. Obviously, given your professional life, there's some obvious connections to that. Tell us a little bit more about this, the value of the game, I think, to understanding leadership, but also this use of the sports metaphor and its connection to sports and some of the sports figures that you actually talk about in the book.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I certainly use, basketball metaphors and football metaphors. But given my background in boxing, a lot of the analogies I use come from the boxing ring. And I do think that there's a lot of similarities between what the best boxers do and what the best bid whist players do. I think, for example, about, how great Floyd Mayweather is as a fighter and how he can transition instantaneously from offense to defense. When he transitions from defense to offense, right, he's got all the tools in his arsenal, the jabs and the crosses and the hooks and the uppercuts and the chin and the temperament and the meanness and all this sort of stuff. That sort of variety, that sort of fluidity and creativity seems to me to characterize the best bid whist players as well, right? They're not always playing defense and bidding conservatively. At the same time, they're not always bidding hyper aggressively. You don't know which way they're coming at you. So I think that the comparisons between the best bid whist players and the best boxers is an apt one.
Hmm. So tell us about team. We've sort of discussed the teamwork aspect of it, just like spades. It has this important teamwork element to it.
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit more about how the teams work within the game.
Sure. I'll tell you what, this goes to me to something I learned all the way back in second grade, right? Because back then they sort of divided us. I'm an older guy, divided us into, the regular reading group, the fast reading group, and the slow reading group. And one of my buddies was in the slow reading group. And it was always kind of painful when he was, required to read out loud. But one day we couldn't go outside for recess. And the teacher was trying to sneak a little math into what was supposed to be our playtime. She had us playing dominoes. And we were playing dominoes with these big, wooden block dominoes. And my buddy, Jackie Woods is his name, man, he dominated, right? He could, add up the multiples of five and strategize and play his dominoes and say, give me 15, give me 20, that sort of thing. And even then it occurred to me again that there's more to games, right, than just the fun of it, that it can reveal sort of, intellectual prowess and that sort of thing. I emphasize the fun and the joy and the thrill of bid whist, but it's not lost on me. And I hope to get to share this with young people and such, that when you're playing bid whist, you're building teamwork muscles. You're building strategic thinking muscles, right? You're building risk assessment muscles. You've got to communicate with your partner. So you're building those communication muscles as well. So I think that those sort of life skills that are reinforced by bid whist are a secondary, but a powerful aspect of the game.
Yeah, I think it's a good point here about what it can teach us about life, but also how card games might be used in the classroom. Remember, when I was in the AmeriCorps when it first started years ago, and I created this card game, and math cards, flashcards, but I turned it into a kind of hopscotch game for the students who were really struggling with math. And they had such a fun just because they were moving around and they were doing hopscotch, but it was to learn math.
Absolutely.
And they came away learning math. And the value and power of games and teaching us about math, about strategy, about leadership in life.
100%. Isn't there a phrase for, like, I don't think it's called experiential learning, but isn't there a phrase for, I know what I'm thinking, it's like gamification, right? It's, you can gamify the lessons. That doesn't mean that the lessons aren't there and hopefully they'll be useful for people as well.
Right. It's engagement. It's one way, you take the content and you gamify it. And because these students today are very tactile, they're tactile learners, they're hands-on. They want to get up and move around and touch things. And I think it is a good way for any student to learn, not that just the students who tend to be more tactile. I think they're all tactile at the moment and very much hands on. And I think there's a greater realization of that among academics and educators, realizing, hey, we have to get the attention of these students. How do we get their attention and get them to learn this lesson? And I think your book, the value of this book, taking this game that's been around for a long time right, to gamify something doesn't mean that you have to jump on a computer necessarily. You know, I think the point that you're making in the value of this game, you also make, you have some stories in this book about the different players, both men and women. And you just talked, you know, brought us through the history, the Pullman porters and the men who were playing the game on the trains. Is it more popular among men? Or tell us some stories about the women who also played.
Yeah, that is a fair question. I was thrilled when I read Michelle Obama's book and she mentioned BidWhist. I was thrilled when I read Valerie Jarrett's book and she mentioned BidWhist. I was watching Rustin, the movie Rustin, not long ago, and they were talking about how Ella Baker was a fierce BidWhist player. So certainly there, you know, are women who play. And I have to say that, you know, when you go to the tournaments and whatnot, man, you know, the women are doing their thing. They're, you know, you don't have to have separate divisions for the men and the women. You know, there's equal power, you know, among the men and the women. So it's definitely, you know, not just a game for men. I wanted to go back, though, to something that you talked about, you know, sort of the intellectual components of these games. One of the arguments I make in the gist of BidWhist is that the trump card game tradition, the trick-taking game tradition, is no less ancient and no less grand than the chess tradition. Mm-hmm. And I make two other points. One is that, you know, trump card games are even more challenging than chess. Mm-hmm. And here's why. With chess, all the pieces are on the board. So all the information is available, you know, to both of the players. With card games, some of the information is hidden. You don't know what your opponents are holding. You don't know what your partner is holding, right? And in addition to that, part of the argument that I make is that with artificial intelligence, the best computers can beat the best chess players, but they can't beat the best card players yet. And part of the reason for that is that with card games, you also have to deal with uniquely human capabilities, right? The ability to deceive, to bluff, you know, outright lying. And the computers haven't mastered that yet. So I think that the trump card game tradition deserves no less respect than the chess tradition. And within the trump card game tradition, you know, bridge is sort of the leading game. And I enjoy bridge. I'm, you know, happy that bridge players so far seem to be embracing the gist of BidWhist. But I make the argument that the 21st century standard bearer for this ancient tradition of trump card games should be BidWhist. And the reason for that is because with respect to bridge, to even start to play, you know, you have to take classes for, you know, 2 months, 3 months, just to sort of learn the language of the auction and that sort of thing. With respect to BidWhist, you know, you can get into the card play action pretty quickly. It doesn't mean, though, that it's a more simple game than bridge. In fact, I make the argument, and we've got the evidence in the gist of BidWhist, to show why BidWhist is an even more complex game than bridge. So that part thrills me because the Pullman porters, you know, who we mentioned earlier, and the people who passed down BidWhist, the culture that passed down BidWhist, passed down an art form that's, you know, truly impressive and enthralling. So yeah, so I'm a big cheerleader, a big ambassador for BidWhist.
Yeah, you know, like you say, you know, in the subtitle, culturally rich. And the aspects of African-American culture, like playing the dozens, right? The tricksterism, the dozens, mm-hmm. all of those things are wrapped up into this game.
100%. You know, the best players, you know, they not only defeat you with their strategic prowess with the cards, but they can get you with their wit and their verbal acuity. But that adds to the laughter, that adds to the excitement, that adds to the fun.
Mm-hmm. And the point where one boy, I was reading the book where one of the players was like sort of shamed out of the house or sent out of the house.
But listen, that might have been me. I've taken my share of whoopings. And I've had to, you know, we call it rise and fly. I've had to rise and fly on many occasions. But, you know, you lick your wounds, you try to get better and come back and, you know, send the other people away next time.
So as we come to the sort of conclusion of our conversation, which I wanted to extend it because it's really a brilliant way to think about African-American culture and builds into a discussion of strategy, leadership, education, all those lessons that are wrapped up in this game. But in a world of computers, social media, TikTok, and all these computer-based games, this two-part question, I think, is what explains the resurgence of BidWhist and how does it compete with all these computer-based games? But I think you started to answer that anyway when you said the best chess players are getting beat by the computers, but the best BidWhist players and card game players are not.
Yeah, and I think all of that just speaks to the human component of these games, meaning, you know, the human component of the connection, especially the face-to-face connection. You know, I play BidWhist on the apps, and that's fine, but it does not replace playing cards in person, because you get that, you know, you get the wit of not just the people at the table, but the people in the room who might not even play cards yet. And you get the laughter and you get the warmth. So that human connection, that human bonding, and to your larger point about fusing these games with, you know, other sort of issues, I came across a quote from the visual artist, Carrie Mae Weems. And the quote was, "Within seriousness, there is little room for play. But within play, there is tremendous room for seriousness." And that sort of reminds me of, you know, what we were talking about earlier with the Pullman Porters and how, you know, they sustained their bond and later made their contributions in part based on, you know, camaraderie built at the BidWhist table. I suspect that, you know, that you and Little Joker back in college, that, you know, you guys were also talking about, you know, classes and life and things beyond the card table. I know that the three men who taught me BidWhist, Randy Nixon, Terry Brown, Sean Long, I know that as we played cards in law school, we were thinking about, you know, what classes should we take? You know, what kind of lawyers do we want to be? What firms do we want to attempt to work at? What kind of husbands do we want to be? What kind of fathers? What kind of men do we want to be? So there was certainly some room for seriousness and dreaming and aspiration, even as we were playing cards. So, yeah, I think that, you know, playing cards provides a sort of a gateway, certainly to a larger world.
So as we conclude our discussion today, what's next for you in terms of books? A book about spades, maybe? No. What's your next big project?
A couple of things I'd like to say. First is, despite the wonderful name of this program, when I play BidWhist, one thing I don't want to be is black in Boston, right? Because I don't want them sending me to Boston talking that smack that you referenced earlier. That's not that's a no-no in Boston, in BidWhist. So, but I'm having so much fun talking to people about the gist of BidWhist on our book tour, meeting people who play, hearing their stories. And I'm convinced that as I learn more about the game from talking with people, as I hear additional stories, there could well be a follow-up to the gist of BidWhist.
No, I think so. I think it's so, you know, important, I think, the points you make about history and culture, African-American history and culture. So I hope you continue to write about this and sort of share this knowledge with the world. So I want to thank you so much for joining me today to talk about this, your important book, The Gist of BidWhist, The Culturally Rich Card Game from Black America for You. And I hope everyone listening will go out and read this book, learn how to play BidWhist. Thank you.
And Dr. Williams, one quick thing, if I may. Sure. You were kind enough to read an early version of the book. Since we sent that version to you, the title has changed slightly. It is The Gist of BidWhist, The Culturally Rich Card Game from Black America. And, you know, we also have, an author's note that's been added and that sort of thing. But I really appreciate you taking time to read that early version. And I appreciate you taking time to have me on to chat today.
No, absolutely. Thank you for, you know, just taking your time out today.